I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
The Agora Podcast Network. Agora is a marketplace of the mind where intelligent, independent podcasts meet curious and discerning listeners. Our network of shows includes
American Biography,
The Bohemian Podcast,
How Jamaica Conquered the World,
The History of the Papacy,
The History of England,
The History of Alchemy Podcast,
Mid-Atlantic,
When Diplomacy Fails,
1001 Conversations,
History of Anglo-Saxon England,
The Secret Cabinet from Germany,
10 American Presidents,
The History of Germany Podcast,
The Agora Podcast Network.com. Listen to Agora today.
My name is Kate.
My name's Joe.
My name's Nicola.
My name is Suzanne Hakimi.
My name is Mary Parkinson.
I'm in Hope House as a client. I have had addiction issues throughout
Hope
my
House,
life, including
addiction,
an eating disorder,
heroin, crack,
addiction
drink,
to drugs,
methadone,
to alcohol.
I'm here because it got really bad.
At long last, 1001 Conversations is available to download from iTunes and all good podcatchers.
This was a place where women worked to help other women.
It's the story of a cultural superpower that danced and sprinted its way to success. It brought the world reggae, Colin Powell, Rastas, hip-hop, Bob Marley, and much more. Its story is told to you in full colour for your podcasting ears. It's the story of how Jamaica conquered the world. Search for it on iTunes, How Jamaica Conquered the World. It's probably the best least-known podcast in podcastdom. Search for it today.
Mr. Pop.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
87 years ago,
when in the course of human events,
and so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of 10 American Presidents. In this show, I'm joined by author and historian David Petrucia, who massively narrated the life of FDR for us last episode. Say hello, David.
Hello.
How are you? Do you have a good Christmas?
Yes, a very good Christmas and a good New Year's, traveling all about the North American continent, or at least the northeastern part of America.
What did Santa get you?
What did he get me? Good Lord.
Any weighty historical tomes?
No, but I bought a book just the other day in New York City, which was an oral history of Manhattan from the 1890s to the 1940s. So you actually were able to read someone who had met Teddy Roosevelt in like 1893.
Oh, wow.
Or a survivor of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. And I was reading that on the train last night.
That's really interesting because something which I've never disclosed to any of the listeners, I'm a bit of an urbanist. I'm absolutely fascinated by cities. And I'm currently working on a new podcast with the New Statesman called City Metric, which is all about cities and how they work. So I'm absolutely fascinated by the history of New York and Manhattan. And so you'll have to give me a read of that.
I will. It's called You Must Remember This. That's the name of the book. It was a big book to carry back. But I found it in Greenpoint, Brooklyn for $4, and it was a great find.
Well, as we say in Britain, I'll have Bagsy on that afterwards, after you've read it. But this is not a show to be talking about the history of New York per se. This is our question and answer show, where you, the listener, can pose questions or have posed questions to our expert to clear up any questions that you might have had after listening to the last show. But David, first, the first question comes from me over in a chilly Toronto. When and how did your interest in history first start?
It started when I was a little kid and I was fascinated by the presidents. And so I memorized them in order and all the things about them. And at that point, there were certainly fewer of them to memorize. but I carried it off at a very tender age. So much so that an uncle of mine built a little replica of the White House for me to keep little statuettes of all the presidents. So instead of toy soldiers, I had toy presidents. And another relative gave me an illustrated history of the presidents. And so I was just off and running from then on. And, you know, the people would say, "Oh, little David, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, a fireman, a policeman, a cowboy?" And I'd say a historian.
Oh, wow.
And it took me a while to get there, but eventually I did.
You sound somewhat like a bit of a strange young boy, right, David? But okay, which of those little president figurines was the most handsome?
The most handsome? Boy, I think, you know, Franklin Pierce was known as Handsome Frank. As opposed to Handsome Frank Roosevelt, who also a handsome fellow. You know, they're all interesting in their little costumes. The beginning of the Revolutionary era up to Monroe. And I always fancied the little straw hat that Calvin Coolidge had in his hand, et cetera, et cetera. So they're all interesting in their own way and interesting in, say, their girth of the girth era of McKinley and Taft and McKinley. It's like, boy, those guys are big. And even TR, for that matter.
So, talking about TR, what is it about the progressive era and, let's say, FDR, if we're coming back onto the show that we did together, that so fascinates you? Because you've written, ostensibly, a lot of your writing is about those eras, isn't it?
I've always fancied myself as a 1920s person of interest and historically. But lately it's occurred to me that also I've been very much interested in the teens. And they're very different eras. The teens are almost like late Victorian. If you take a look at how things appear in terms of culture or fashions or style, there's a tectonic shift that occurs in the early 1920s. But, you know, this is America where it's taking off and everything is just bursting with energy and excitement. And both halves of that, of the progressive era and the reaction to it, which occurs in the 1920s, just fascinate the hell out of me, not only politically, but culturally.
It's kind of interesting being British and kind of being aware of American history. but, you know, not necessarily all of the detail. I wasn't even really aware that colloquially that era is called the Progressive Era. So I wasn't really aware that the era was actually called the Progressive Era. But if somebody wants to neatly chronologically tie that era up, when does a Progressive Era start and end in your perspective?
Neatly from around the very late 1890s to 1920. It all sort of crashes with the end of the Wilson administration. But the Progressive Era reforms stop right around 1916. There's a flurry of activity in a congressional session that year, but you have the emphasis on reform. There are reforms like the Federal Reserve Act and labor legislation, etc., etc., but it's an emphasis on electoral reform, battling the big city machines, primary legislation, changing the method of election of United States senators from the state legislatures to the popular vote, initiative, referendum, a clean government thing. But it's coincidental with the populist era, where William Jennings Bryan gets up and running slightly before that in 1896 when he's running against McKinley. That's a more rural, economic, anti-Wall Street sort of peasants with pitchforks matter of politics. But they share, if not styles or geography, they do share certain interests in taking down the big guys of Wall Street. And you see with TR in that 1912 campaign, his third party run, where he is against the accumulated power of big business, Wall Street monopolies, however you want to call it.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Give me your help not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America.
So our first question is from listener Adam Vanami, who's from Denver, Colorado.
My question is about the relationship between Stalin and FDR. In the podcast, you insinuate that Churchill really saw Stalin for what he was. And I'm wondering if you thought FDR kind of had his blinders on when he was dealing with Stalin and really didn't understand what he was going to become the same way that Churchill did.
The difference between Churchill and Roosevelt in regards to Stalin really should be preceded by the question of Churchill versus Roosevelt in regards to their attitudes toward communism, Bolshevism, whatever. Churchill is a very avid anti-communist, anti-Bolshevik from the get-go, from 1917. So his attitude toward Stalin is going to be colored by that. Roosevelt is not really an anti-communist at really any point. His administration, one of the first things he does is to recognize the Soviet Union. Neither Hoover, nor Coolidge, nor Harding, nor Woodrow Wilson had done that. And then you see his attitude, Franklin Roosevelt's attitude towards domestic communists. There's a famous situation where he's talking to Martin Dies, one of the early heads of the House Un-American Activities Committee, where he supposedly tells Dies, some of my best friends are communists. So he thinks he can work with these fellows, and he thinks he can probably charm just about anybody. He's also anti-colonialist, so he will distance himself at the summits between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin against Churchill and the British Empire. And he really believes that he can work with Stalin and create a better world. Now, one of the things that is a carryover from Franklin Roosevelt to Wilsonianism is Wilson has his League of Nations and Franklin Roosevelt has his United Nations. And to get Stalin and the Soviet Union into this new United Nations, he's willing to make concessions, just as Woodrow Wilson was willing to make concessions at Versailles on point after point to get his League of Nations. Roosevelt is willing to concede to Stalin, who he thinks is some sort of a Democrat and you know, a progressive in his own right, to get Stalin and the Soviet Union into the League of Nations, and also to coordinate Stalin's offensives with the invasion of France. Now, that's sort of ironic because Stalin has been pushing for the invasion of Normandy, for this second front anyway, so he should be on board with that. And Roosevelt also wants Stalin to come in against the war in Japan once the Nazis are knocked out. So there's all these reasons why he's playing up to Stalin. Towards the end of his life, I think he catches on a bit more to the danger of Stalin and what a double crosser and what an aggressive fellow he's going to be in the post-war era. But it comes very late, and we get into the question of what would he have done later, which is always that what if sort of history, which I'm kind of uncomfortable with, because when I was associated with baseball history, and I was, people would ask me who's going to win the World Series. And I would say to them, I'm a historian, not a prophet. Mm-hmm. So there's I think we're going to be getting a bunch of questions like what would have happened if. Mm-hmm. And those questions are always difficult to answer. I'll try to give them my best shot. But what Stalin and Roosevelt would have come to had Roosevelt lived is, of course, in the realm of something beyond history.
Okay. So you can tell you've done this broadcast podcast stuff before because you're foreshadowing future questions.
An das deutsche Volk. Seit der Reichsgründung ist es durch
1914, June, Sarajevo. The heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, assassinated, killed by a Serbian nationalist. About 6 weeks later, World War breaks out. Germany, Austria-Hungary, Russia, France, Britain, everyone is drawn into it starting in August, and then will America be drawn in?
So we have a question from, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of your name, so I do apologize, but I'm not up on my Latvian, but Kristaps Andresens, I think, who does a very good podcast called The Eastern Border, which looks at Eastern Europe's relationship to Russia and the Soviet Union. So his question comes all the way from Riga in Latvia. And he says, this is a very painful question to me, at least. It's about the Baltic states and their annexation by the USSR in World War II. Over here, many believe that FDR was weak compared to Stalin and that he was completely overwhelmed and outmaneuvered by him during the peace talks. In some part, people here believe that FDR is also at least partly responsible for the occupation and the Sovietization of Eastern European countries, because he didn't even try to oppose Stalin when it came to these countries being part of the USSR. Many people here were hoping that the USA would go to war to free Eastern European countries from the USSR still way late into the 1950s, but that never happened. And FDR's policies have largely contributed to the fact that even now we're wary about NATO and American guarantees towards our country. So I'd like to know more about FDR's attitude towards Stalin and whether there were any sources that mentioned what FDR thought about the Baltic states.
In terms of the Baltic states, I'm not sure about that specifically, but to back it up for our listeners, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania were part of the deal of the Hitler-Stalin pact. When Hitler moves into Western Poland, Stalin moves into Eastern Poland, seizes that in 1939, and then follows that up with the annexation of these three small Baltic nations and an invasion of Finland. So Russia and Germany are allies. Stalin gets lucky in that Britain and France never go to war against him. I mean, logically, if the issue is the invasion of Poland and France and Britain are going to declare war on Germany, they should have also declared war on Russia, but they don't. They don't bite off more than they can chew on that. And if you're going to undo what the initial impetus for war was, you should restore an independent Poland with its borders, which we do not. You should restore the Baltic states, which we do not. One of the things which Franklin Roosevelt and the Allies could have done, and which Churchill was more interested in doing, was to strike more at the Nazis, say, through the southern European theater and through Italy, and forestall how far Stalin could come westward into Europe, either in the Baltics or more in the central part of Europe, say through Austria or Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia. The Baltic states were probably too far gone for us to forestall a Soviet occupation of those countries. And how you would dislodge them with this massive Red Army, which was much larger than the force, numerically, than the forces which Britain and the United States and its various allies had in the western part of Europe. But, you know, the success of the Red Army is in many ways predicated on Roosevelt's lend-lease aid, whether it's tanks or foodstuffs or any sort of materiel.
David, I'm going to quickly jump in because one of the things that I found really fascinating about working with you on the FDR show was the subtle slant, from a British perspective anyway, of the war. I.e., you know, the war doesn't start till 1941 is the most obvious thing, where us Brits have been fighting for 2 years previous. And of course, if I was Chinese, I'd probably be saying it started in the mid 1930s. So
Manchuria.
Yeah, Manchuria in 1932. What? Yeah, exactly. Now, if I was Russian, I would probably not even mention lend-lease from FDR as being a contributing factor as to why the Soviet armies repelled the Nazis in the end. So from a, you know, without digging deeply into the weeds here, how much did that specifically really help the Soviet war effort? Because from a Soviet perspective, it's a case of, well, we moved our factories back behind the Urals, we had this capacity, we rallied everybody to the fatherland, and etc. And we did this by ourselves, and you know, the folk in the West were just you know, at best it was some rearguard action, but we really took the fight to the Nazis. And that is definitely a Russian stroke Soviet perspective on it, isn't it?
Well, in terms of blood and manpower, it's the Soviet contribution is the biggest.
Yeah, overwhelmingly so.
But when you've had your territory occupied to the borders of Moscow and Leningrad and to Stalingrad, beautiful downtown Stalingrad, you've lost a lot. You know, you might be able to move factories back, but you can't move them all. You can't move your Ukrainian breadbasket, you know, to Siberia. So a lot of stuff is they make up the slack with with American materiel when Vice President Wallace, Henry Wallace, visits Siberia during the war. He just is amazed at how much he sees in Siberia and in the hinterlands, all marked "Made in USA." So it's a balancing thing, but we could have probably cut off some of that aid as a leverage point as things progressed in 44, 45, when things get dicey between the United States and the Soviets. But Roosevelt is not seeing that until very late, even after. Now, the fate of the Baltic nations is tied in with the fate of Poland. And the fate of Poland is tied into the 1944 election, where Polish Americans are getting wary about what's going to happen to their country in the post-war. And will they turn on Roosevelt? And Roosevelt has to court Polish Americans. There's some polling data which indicates that a bunch of them, which the Polish vote was historically very, very strongly Democratic, as Democratic as the Jewish American vote, or as Democratic as the Black American vote is it becomes during Roosevelt. And if they jump ship, they could help switch that election in 1944. So Roosevelt has to court them. His situation is not helped by the fact that when Polish home army units revolt in Moscow, or in Warsaw, at the instigation of the Soviet Union, and then are hung out to dry, they are set up to die in this Warsaw Rebellion by the Soviets. And when the Americans and the British want to get supplies to their Polish allies in Warsaw, Stalin says, no, you can't land your planes here in our air bases, which are closer. We will not help these people. And that should be a wake-up call as to what Stalin is really about. But FDR is not particularly interested in this. He expresses some frustration about Eastern Europeans, Eastern European borders. He just doesn't seem to care.
Let's go on. We have a question from Brett von Schlosser. I'm going to say that again. Brett von Schlosser. I've always been curious about the whole initial thing. We've had related presidents in the past. There's two presidents Adams, the two presidents Harrisons, with no major name modifications. But the changes with Roosevelt, Teddy is President Roosevelt, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt is always FDR. Why? When Kennedy comes along, was he trying to emulate FDR by going for JFK? After that, it seems like a similar thing repeats itself with the Bushes in a way. George H.W. Bush is President Bush. George W. Bush is always referred to simply as W. So what is this naming convention?
Well, TR starts it off. I mean, it's not just Teddy Roosevelt. He's the first initial FDR maybe emulating TR. He certainly tried to emulate him in many a way stylistically early in his campaign. So TR begats FDR. JFK, John F. Kennedy, I'm not quite sure what was the impetus for that, because the relationship between the Kennedy family and Franklin Roosevelt certainly was up and down. Joe Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's father, is an ally of Franklin Roosevelt at first, and then they split on the issue of the war and isolationism. But the guy that was not mentioned in that question, who has the closest relationship to Franklin Roosevelt and is another initial guy, is LBJ.
Of course, yes.
LBJ regarded Franklin Roosevelt as one of his daddies. You know, anyone who was like a protege of or a mentor of LBJ was one of his daddies. And he thought of himself as the great society as the New Deal 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted that to be his legacy, but he gets caught up in the war like Franklin Roosevelt does, and it doesn't turn out as well. It turns out sort of like a Woodrow Wilson sort of war, except we don't win that war. Now, with the Bushes, that's kind of interesting because we don't get into, we've got the first name thing being the same, like the Adamses, like John Adamses and John Quincy Adamses, Adams. But, we didn't call John Quincy Adams Q. But once we're into the initial thing, and not only initials, but think of acronyms. Think of how things are shortened words now, which goes on all the time, where we've had linguistic differences, where who in the 19th century would have called vegetables veggies, okay?
Uh-huh.
And then we create all these words now. Look at all the hashtag type words or this combination of words where there's like a whole new language evolving. Now, part of it is because of technology, but we are really playing around with our language and just combining words and breaking them apart and having all these initials and shortcuts where we never had it before, where the technology is evolving, but also so is our linguistics. It's the roaring 20s. Life is good. 1 year, unemployment gets down to 1%. There's virtually no inflation in the country, maybe 2% tops any given year. The gross national product is growing by leaps and bounds. Tax rates are coming down. Life is good for America. And so Alfred E. Smith loses to Herbert Hoover that year. But while he's losing, Franklin D. Roosevelt wins by an eyelash. He's governor of the state of New York, the most populous, prosperous, and rich and influential state in the Union. And suddenly, a front runner for the presidency of the United States of America.
Going back to World War II, we have a question from Stephen Guerra, who runs the excellent History of the Papacy podcast.
Hi, David and Roy Field. I really enjoyed your episode on FDR. I had another question, and it was whether, given that the Nazi Germany went and declared war almost immediately after Japan attacked the United States, did Roosevelt and his administration have a plan, like a plan B, just in case Germany didn't declare war on the United States? What was going to be the plan had Germany not declared war? What would have the situation been with the war in Europe? Thanks again.
Well, that's one of those what-if questions, always fascinating, but highly speculative. We are already in an undeclared naval war with Nazi Germany in the North Atlantic. That would have accelerated. Perhaps there would have been some greater incident that would have caused us to go to a full-blown war with Nazi Germany. But with the American people all rightfully het up against Japan, it would have been very difficult in the absence of a declared war to keep diverting or to divert our resources to Europe as opposed to fighting the war against the Japanese, who had attacked us directly and who the Americans, for one reason or another, were very, very much opposed to. So if Hitler does not take that move, and he does not have to, the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians are all involved in the Tripartite Pact, the Axis. It's an alliance, but it is a defensive alliance. This explains, unless Nazi Germany is attacked or unless Japan is attacked, the others do not have to go to their aid. If they launch an aggressive war, say with Germany versus the Soviet Union, then Japan doesn't have to come in and Japan doesn't have to go to war against the Soviet Union. But Hitler goes completely haywire in December 1941 and causes that attack. So what happens if he doesn't? It really forestalls Normandy, the invasion of Italy, the invasion of North Africa, leading the British to do it on their own. And what probably would have happened then is that the Soviet Union ends up with even more of post-war Europe than it does after 1945. 1933, Franklin Roosevelt is about to be president, but he might never really get there, even though he's won a landslide victory, because he takes a fishing trip on a yacht off the coast of Florida and stops in Miami for another campaign address, even though the campaign is won. And as he sits in his car, an Italian immigrant, Giuseppe Zangara, pulls out a revolver and fires once, twice, again and again and again. Franklin Roosevelt could have died that day. Instead, a bullet hits the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak. Anton Cermak says, "I'm glad it was me and not you."
When the first shot was fired, I realized he was shooting at someone, and I taken my right arm and pushed the pistol up just as hard as I could.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Franklin Roosevelt will go on to become president.
Craig Beck in Sydney, Australia, a history teacher. Hey guys, through my own studies, I've learnt that FDR learnt much from watching Woodrow Wilson. What do you think is one of the major foreign policy lessons that he actually learnt from Woodrow Wilson in office? And how do you think this affected the way he handled America's entry into World War II?
Roosevelt, of course, is handed this great entree into the war, a great but terrible entree with Pearl Harbor, where there is no choice about America coming in. Wilson is a very stubborn individual. Roosevelt, as we mentioned earlier, does not learn from Wilson's experience with the League of Nations and having to make so many concessions to his allies in order to get it through. He's making concessions to Stalin in order to get the League of Nations through. But what he does learn is he needs to cooperate more so with the Republicans and with domestic opinion than Wilson ever learns. And this is something from my previous book, 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. And it's a letter which Franklin Roosevelt writes to Eleanor about Wilson's failure to bring the Republicans and the Congress into the game about treaty making. And he writes, "The business of the President and the Secretary of State negotiating and signing a treaty and then handing it cold to the Senate is all wrong. If I were doing it, I'd take the Senate and maybe the House into my confidence as far as I could. I'd get them committed to a principle and then work out the details in negotiations. In that way, the thing could be secured." So I think he's going to work with the Congress more, work with the Republicans more. You know, even at the beginning of his administration, he does something which Wilson has no interest in. Wilson has no interest in bringing Republicans into his administration, just has no use for it. But what does Roosevelt do? He brings in guys like Harold Ickes and Henry Wallace, and I think even Wooden, the Secretary of the Treasury, is a Republican. So he's attempting to bring in a nonpartisan coalition of progressives into his administration very early on. And then when the war comes in, he's working with Frank Knox, the 1936 vice presidential candidate for the Republicans, Henry Stimson, an old war horse from the Taft administration. And he even brings in his 1940 presidential rival, Wendell Willkie, to serve as his personal ambassador to the British and to develop support for the war, the upcoming war effort.
From Hannibal, Missouri, we have a question from David P. Hazen. "I've always wondered that given FDR's close study of Wilson and his recent experience of digging the economy out of the Depression and the mini-depression of the late 1930s, what considerations did FDR have for a post-war economic contraction like the one that followed World War I?
There's a tremendous mobilization of the American economy in both world wars. In World War I, the railroads are taken over by the Woodrow Wilson administration, and the amazing level of control that occurs should not be underestimated by any level, because it comes out of an almost vacuum of federal power over the economy. So the ramping up is far more startling under Wilson and the war than it is under FDR and the New Deal or his war effort. And Roosevelt, you see, the author Jonah Goldberg makes the point over and over again in his book Liberal Fascism, how the impetus for the New Deal or for liberal economic programs is a mobilization akin to war, control over the economy very much like a wartime effort, like a wartime crusade. So Roosevelt will do that, and in his 1933 inaugural address talks about having the powers akin to a wartime leader. And so you've got a ramping up of government control of the economy massively in World War II. How Roosevelt would have dealt with the post-war economy and the downturn, I would guess that he would see this as a wonderful opportunity, much as Rahm Emanuel or would talk about, you know, don't let a crisis go to waste. So you could have a second New Deal come in to send people to CCC camps or WPA contract projects to deal with the 11 million people coming out of the service who it would be assumed would be unemployed where the economy would not be able to turn around and go back from making tanks to making, you know, Chevrolets and DeSotos very quickly. But what happens is, in the aftermath of World War II, is that the Congress is becoming far more conservative the longer FDR goes on. So by the late 30s, the New Deal impetus and the New Deal programs are not only not being implemented further, but that they're being shut down. The Democratic Congress in the last years of Roosevelt and the first years of Truman are cutting back marginal tax rates. And then the Republicans come in 1946. And this is into Congress. And this is an important point in terms of such speculation. People really don't like wars. They don't like wars even if they're successful, and they don't like the people who brung them to that dance or who oversee their war efforts. So that a couple years after LBJ wins his 1964 landslide, the Republicans have big gains in Congress. You see the pushback against both Bushes politically, father and son. You see the pushback against the Democrats in 1920, having led America to a very successful war. And, of course, in 1945, you see Winston Churchill thrown out of office by the British. So Roosevelt probably would have had to deal with a Republican and a very, very conservative Congress in 1947-48, if he lives. He would not have been able to implement the sort of program that he would have wanted to.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly there, David.
You said
that people don't like wars. Surely the turning point in terms of a Western perspective on war is arguably is World War II, because if you look at the outbreak of World War One, whether it was Germany or London, people were absolutely enthusiastic.
Yeah,
for war.
I think I should clarify that. I think after they get into it, they determine they don't like it, because we take a look at those newsreels of the German people in particular, but all throughout Western or all throughout Europe, where people are going to war enthusiastically. Now, that's less the case in 1939. There are accounts of people marching off to war in Germany, and the German people, and I think they've done some sampling of opinion, even the Nazis, where people in Germany were very wary of what this was going to be about. It's only until they overrun France and the Low Countries, and it looks like, well, that turned out well, that the enthusiasm levels ramp up in Germany. But up to that point, they were, you know, they had seen so many dead that they were very nervous about the whole thing as well. And even Stalin is, you know, he's willing to go in for these little wars or occupations with the Baltics and Poland, but you know, he doesn't take on the big guys on his own.
Very true. It's interesting, again, from a British perspective, somebody who's always been a student of history. Britain goes to war in 1939 with an empire, and automatically Australia, New Zealand, and Canada declare war as well. And we come out of that war 6 years later, a small country, where we're absolutely bankrupt. On paper, we still have an empire, but the war hastens the empire's end. But what the war does from a British perspective is actually to galvanise and to create a small Britain, a nation-state Britain, and
The fulcrum of that identity is very much the Blitz and the fact that we are this small country, and for some 18 months we faced off the worst tyranny that the world had ever known. So it's interesting. Did Britain go to war gladly? Absolutely not. But that war-fighting generation takes great pride in actually the fact that in their service, and also the creation of a new Britain, one which has welfare safety nets. The National Health Service is one of the great things actually to come out of that experience. And moving this slightly on to America, it appears to me that the big difference in terms of World War One and the post-depression that the United States suffers then as opposed to World War II is surely that there were no... Europe had been decimated, so there was a massive demand. Literally, whatever the Americans did post-World War II, there's going to be a massive demand for goods. And really, this is all about the Marshall Plan, isn't it? That you gave Europe the money, not only to rebuild itself, but also to purchase American goods. And that's what fueled this economic boom, which lasted all the way to the early 1970s. And that's what didn't happen in World War One, because Britain, France, just were not devastated. And even Germany wasn't as devastated as it was in 1919, as opposed to it was in 1945.
Yes, certainly Berlin isn't blown to bits in 1918, nor London, really, despite dirigible attacks. And northern France is... The devastation is... The physical devastation of the territory is pretty much limited to northern France in World War. So there's this huge, huge difference... at least in Western Europe. I mean, in Eastern Europe, I mean, everything is a mess, or in the old Russian Empire. And of course, the economic dislocations caused by the fall of the Austrian Empire. But yes, that's a massive difference. But also, there's a galloping of technology, which we're still seeing today, and it's probably accelerated, where we could make all sorts of mistakes economically, or there can be this problem here or there, but we are just inventing newer, better things, ways to do things all the time. And the Depression, and I think the war itself, short circuits where this economic technological boom is going to come from, but that it takes off in the 50s and 60s, and right now the whole electronic thing, which causes us to not have to stockpile things or go to stores or to allocate resources, 100 times better than they were before, or not have to invest in an army of secretaries with gallons of whiteout to get a simple memo out anymore. And as much as this creates dislocations in manufacturing jobs or clerical jobs, it just makes life easier for everyone and brings the costs of everything down. And I think all the going back into that progressive era is it's the technology, not the politics. Reading that book I was telling you about earlier, the book about Manhattan in the 1890s and 1910, reading about the people living in those lousy tenements on the Lower East Side and what they had to go through, and how things were made in the sweatshops and all that. It's once we evolve the technology and not the politics or the labor laws or anything else, which enables people to live better lives. I mean, certainly that's the key. And in some of those mills, I have some memories of how they operated in my own life. It was a pretty primitive way to go, as opposed to all the automation and e-this and e-that of today.
Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration, and I am certain that on this day my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure, will revive, and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The nation demands action. In 1933, it needs action.
I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe.
Another reading that I got, David, from our show together was, and first off, just so the listeners are clear, I'm somebody who is politically left of centre, if that hadn't been made abundantly clear. And I appreciate that someone who's politically left of centre, in Britain it means one thing, and in America it means that I'm probably further over to the left, because your centre of political gravity is somewhat to the right of everybody in Western Europe. So I'll hold that up there just so people know exactly where I'm coming from. One of my readings, actually, of your graphic and detailed description of the New Deal and the, you know, the second round of New Deals and the mini depression of the late 1930s after the Great Depression, was if you look at a government taking control and command of the economy as the United States did in World War II, that actually the New Deal wasn't enough. That actually, if you could take, you know, one reading of this is that if FDR had had the foresight and the vision to absolutely take control, almost Soviet style, of the United States' economy, that the New Deal would have been an absolute qualified success. It was a success in terms of PR, and it was a marginal success in terms of getting those top line figures of unemployment down. But as you explain, looked over the, what, six, well, no, you're American, so the 9 years between him coming into power, or 8 years of him coming into power and then America going to war, the unemployment figures came down by, what, maybe 8% from a high of 24-25%. You know, so it wasn't...
It doesn't get, I think, any lower than 14, or 14 is the average. It's very high. And, of course, how much of that is brought down by... You might have a million people doing, oh, what would be called inhospitably or uncharitably make work jobs. Mm. You know, whether it would be, I mean, they could be valuable, and a lot of the work they did endures. That's one of the things that people see very favorably about the New Deal, is that it created solid, tangible works, whether it was a post office or a bridge, what we call infrastructure today, or sending people out into the woods to clear up brush or tidy up national parks. But if you take the million people out, then the unemployment rate is even higher.
Well, one of the enduring
iconic images of America is the Golden Gate Bridge. And it was only after doing this show that it occurred to me whilst doing the research that that is an infrastructure project from the New Deal.
Right. Of course, some of our iconic projects, you know, precede that. The George Washington Bridge, connecting northern New Jersey and northern Manhattan, which is the only bridge really connecting Manhattan to Jersey, was done under Hoover. And there's an interesting story where a real demagogic fellow from North Carolina alludes to this bridge when he's talking about Herbert Hoover. I'm digressing now, but I wanted to haul this one out. He says, in New York City, they built a bridge and they named it after Hoover because it was it's wet on the bottom, meaning for prohibition, dry on the top, and it goes both ways.
That's a brilliant quote. That's a brilliant quote.
But that guy was a real that guy was a real screwball. He's elected in 1932 in North Carolina, and what he would do is he would play the populist card, where his opponent, his Democratic opponent, the incumbent, he would read from a menu where the guy lived in Washington at the hotel. And talk about how he ordered caviar for breakfast and had to dress in tuxedos to go to lunch. And it was real out Huey Long. And the bad news is that this guy became a serious anti-Semite, even working with known fascists in the Senate. So it really, you see that some of these populist movements have very bad byproducts to them.
Moving swiftly on, I tell you, a lot of the listener questions are kind of obsessed with comparisons with Woodrow Wilson and Craig Beck back in Sydney, Australia. And he says, Woodrow Wilson in the Big Three meeting was considered the optimist amongst Lloyd George, who was the realist, and George Clemenceau, who was the pessimist. What was FDR's stance on what happened at Versailles and Wilson's position on it?
Well, in terms of at Versailles, we really don't know. And we do have we are a witness, or we have some information about Roosevelt coming back with Wilson to America after Versailles, or maybe during Versailles, I'm not quite sure which. And Roosevelt was trying to get some information from Wilson as to what was going on. And Wilson was extremely standoffish about the whole thing. Whether it was about just dealing with Franklin Roosevelt, who heeded the relationship between the two. Well, we might as well get into this, since so many of the questions involve Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and comparing them. Even though Franklin Roosevelt is an early supporter of Woodrow Wilson for the presidency and supports him before the primaries and the convention, organizes Upstate Forum, and gets rewarded by the Woodrow Wilson administration with this post that he dearly wants, Under Secretary of the Navy, which Theodore Roosevelt had before him, and which helps catapult him to the presidency. FDR attempts to gain Wilson's support for a Senate run in 1914, and he doesn't get it. And then he's thinking about running for governor in 1918 of New York. And he makes some crack to Wilson about, well, you know, are people going to support Al Smith, who's a Catholic? And Wilson, you know, is incensed by this remark. He says, well, there's plenty of good Catholics dying in France for this country right now. So button that up, pal. Also, that Roosevelt is undercutting the Wilson administration on the preparedness issue before the war. You have all these issues, and it even goes to the fact that Wilson is incensed at Roosevelt for entertaining someone from the British administration or the British embassy who had been spreading jokes about Wilson's second marriage. So it's not a healthy relationship between the two. That having been said, Wilson is so secretive during these Versailles negotiations. You know, he talks about in the 14 points, open covenants, openly agreed at. And he doesn't even allow anyone from the American delegation to sit in with him when he's with the big three, Clemenceau and Lloyd George. So it's a remarkable situation. Roosevelt, I think, learns from that. But they have very different styles, even though in some ways they are pursuing the same goals. In many ways, the same goals.
Pacific skies, the blow comes. The Jap assassins' bombs bring to America the grim reality of war. War as the Axis wages it. Democracy stunned moves into action. President Roosevelt, grim and determined, goes before Congress with a united nation behind him, demanding vengeance.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Now we're going to go back to Stephen Guerra of the History of the Papacy podcast from Buffalo, New York, for his second question.
I have a question about Roosevelt's earlier career in the New York State Senate. It seems like he straddled the line between upstate New York politics and the Tammany Hall bossism. Did that influence how he made political decisions in his life, and especially in his later career? What lessons did he learn? Did he pick up trusted followers from both camps? And how did that generally affect the way that he governed? It seems to me like he was pragmatic and he often listened to a lot of his advisors. Did he learn those lessons as an upstate New York state senator? Thank you very much, and I really appreciate all the hard work you've done on this project.
That's a great question from Stephen. And can I also just say, there's a great advert for the 10 American Presidents podcast group, is that you can join with other people that love to listen to the show. And Stephen's daughter did a rather brilliant picture, David, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a picture of him just after his state Senate run, which Stephen posted to the Facebook group. It's very much an interpretive impression of Roosevelt, but it's there on the 10 American Presidents Facebook group, and I'd like to thank Stephen for posting that and his little daughter for drawing also. So, but moving swiftly on, to answer Stephen's question, David, what's your answer?
We talk about people now being bi-coastal, you know, being on the West Coast and the East Coast. And Franklin Roosevelt, when Stephen says straddle between Tammany and he's straddling things geographically as well. He sees himself largely as that Hyde Park upstate guy, and upstate, the Hudson Valley is far more rural back then than it is now. But he's also has a home on the Upper East Side on East 65th Street. He had lived earlier in Midtown, and he has business connections and a job in Lower Manhattan. So he knows both areas, you know, very well. When he gets to the state Senate, it's as an upstate reform, non-Tammany, anti-Tammany guy. He's immediately thrown into this situation where he's bucking Tammany Hall on who they will put in for the United States Senate seat, which the legislature can vote on at that point. And he eventually sort of cuts a deal with Tammany where they withdraw their original nominee, but then they nominate, you know, someone equally as acceptable to them, but he gets to declare victory. So in a way, he learns to trim his sails on that early on. He does fight them again in that 1914 Senate race that he wants to do. They put up a candidate, James W. Girard, who was Wilson's ambassador to Berlin, and they crush him. And from that point on, he does not attack them directly. And so he learns that lesson quite well. In the Senate, he does learn something else about Tammany. And in the legislature, in Albany, is where he meets Alfred Emanuel Smith, who, unlike Roosevelt, who is a newcomer and sort of a backbencher, but a very highly visible one in the state Senate, Al Smith is a big shot and a very respected figure in the state assembly. And these guys first meet each other there and at least take a liking and in some ways to each other. And it's probably that basis which causes Smith to turn to Roosevelt early on. We also see that they meet during the 1920 Democratic Convention, but which causes Smith to turn to Roosevelt to nominate him at Madison Square Garden in 1924, where Roosevelt gives that happy warrior speech. And that's what resurrects Roosevelt from polio and defeat in 1920 in that presidential election when Roosevelt is running for vice president, and really gives him the boost up to where Smith, a Tammany guy, reaches out to Roosevelt in 1928 and helps install him into the governorship. No governorship, no White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph.
And to end up Brant Malone says, when did the re-examination of Roosevelt as president occur? David mentioned at the end of the podcast that people have re-evaluated the Roosevelt presidency. But in what ways has this re-evaluation been more positive than before? And what ways has it been more negative?
Well, you're seeing a few more studies about whether the economics of it worked. But I think we're also less close to the whole era. There are people who were not there and who did not see Roosevelt as their personal president, their friend. We see the documentaries where people would write to Roosevelt. Millions of people, I don't know if millions, but hundreds of thousands of people would write to him as their friend, asking for a favor, and this close personal relationship. And the earlier the New Deal historians could put out the facts about Roosevelt, but perhaps not, would perhaps gloss over them quicker. And now we see more about the Roosevelt style, which could often be very duplicitous. And I think people are more comfortable with that, with looking at that and not seeing this as a complete junking of admiration for Roosevelt. So I would say that it's not that his reputation has been downgraded. I think it's less looking at him with blinders. Also, it seemed to me about 10 years ago that when people looked at the three Roosevelts, and there was actually a book out of maybe 5 years ago now called The Three Roosevelt by Roosevelts by James McGregor Burns, that the reputation, or not the reputation, but the interest in them seems to vary as time goes on. And Roosevelt was, Franklin Roosevelt was the big dog for decades and decades. But then what had happened is we're still riding a big Theodore Roosevelt boom, where you see so many books about Roosevelt and there's just this fantastic fascination with him. But also, up to about 10 years ago, you also saw a big, as feminism and issues like that increase, a tremendous greater increase in interest in Eleanor. And Franklin, who had been, you know, the big guy, had almost receded into third place. But now you see him rising up again in public interest. And I think that is because of the poor economy and how you deal with a poor economy, how you deal with a great depression, or how you deal with a great recession.
I think it's a little bit more simpler than that. And this is somebody, again, is a student of history. What I always seem to notice is that at the end of someone's tenure, whether they're a king or a president or an emperor, if they've died on a relative high, at some point there's historical revisionism. And if they've ended their tenure on a relative low, ditto. And the revisionism works in the opposite direction. So if you look at this from an American perspective, somebody like President Grant historically has been a failure, but there is a revisionist out there, or revisionists, and they're saying, but he's a proto-civil rights precursor. He was a friend of African Americans, etc. You have, and then a very dramatic example in the other way, somebody like President Jackson, who has rode a relative high wave of support until relative recently, where revisionism now looked at him and said, he was a slave-owning bastard who trampled on the rights of Native Americans and etc., etc.
So, and Jefferson.
Yes, and absolutely. And Jefferson would be the classic example of that.
And not just because of the slaveholding thing. People are really down on him on a lot of ways, which certainly plays havoc with the old Democratic party custom of holding Jefferson Jackson Day dinners.
Absolutely.
Haven't heard of those in a while. and it goes the other way with Truman and Truman first, and then Eisenhower being ratcheted upwards. The guy where this does not, and Reagan going upwards, and I think even the first Bush, though not the second, but the guy where this is not working for is Lyndon Johnson.
Yes, he's stymied by Vietnam, isn't
right.
he?
Neither ideology, neither wing of American thought is comfortable with him.
Mm. Which I think is somewhat harsh, considering that he took some very brave decisions to do with civil rights, and actually did literally knock heads together and work the American political system. But no, when you look at the optics of his tenure, it's fundamentally it's Vietnam and LBJ. How many kids did he kill today?
Right, and just his personal style, which people overlooked in 1964, but which just doesn't fly.
Absolutely. David, this has been fascinating. We're going to work again together, aren't we?
Yes.
So we're going to do TR.
Yes.
And we are also going to do a new podcast. What's that new podcast?
Well, I think it's 10 or 11 or some number of presidential elections.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to working with you on that, because I actually found your analysis of 1920, 1932, etc., you know, just absolutely brilliant. And it'll be somewhat wasted if we just shoehorn them into the FDR show and then kind of forgot about them. That there's so much more that we can learn about the American political system and how it's developed through looking at its elections. And one thing I definitely want to tackle with you is the crossing over of the Republican Democratic parties, but we'll do that in that series. That's going to be 10 American elections, which we'll try and maybe get the first one out later on this month. Well, I've got to keep you busy. Listen, thank you again, David, for just an amazing FDR show. And the feedback, whether it's been on Twitter or on Facebook or via email to me, has been absolutely tremendous. So thank you again. Now, if you do want to contact me, I am at Royfield on Twitter. So that's R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D. Or you can tweet the show, where we are at the number 10 USAP. Of course, there is the 10 American Presidents website, which is the number 10, again, USP.com, where you can have a look at the shows and maybe write a comment or two. But you, dear listener, I need your help. I need your help to go onto iTunes to write reviews about the show, and please 5-star it. I'm not saying that these shows are perfect, but I've put the work in and my back into it. So please go onto iTunes, write a review, because that means that other listeners throughout the world will see the show and then hopefully listen to it too. So please, iTunes reviews are vitally important. You can send me an email where I'm Royfield. Again, that's R-O-I for India, F-I-E-L-D @gmail.com. And I'll try and get back to you in a timely manner. So that's just about it on FDR. But don't forget, we do have the Facebook group. We can go on to Facebook and join the group. The next show I'm going to do is going to be a little bit of a one-off with Kevin Strad of the History of English, looking at the accents of early American 20th century presidents, because that's one thing that definitely came out of the FDR show, was this mid-Atlantic or transatlantic accent. So look out for that show in the next month or two. And then after that, we'll be delving into the life of President Andrew Jackson. So that's all from me. David, would you like to sign off as well?
I'm signing off.
That's all from us. Take care, guys. See you all next time.
The Agora Podcast Network. Agora is a marketplace of the mind, where intelligent, independent podcasts meet curious and discerning listeners. Our network of shows includes
American Biography,
The Bohemian Podcast,
How Jamaica Conquered the World,
The History of the Papacy,
The History of England,
The History of Alchemy Podcast,
Mid-Atlantic,
When Diplomacy Fails,
1001 Conversations,
History of Anglo-Saxon England,
The Secret Cabinet from Germany,
10 American Presidents,
The History of Germany Podcast,
The AgoraPodcastNetwork.com. Listen to Agora today.
It's the story of a cultural superpower that danced and sprinted its way to success. It brought the world reggae, Colin Powell, Rastas, hip-hop, Bob Marley, and much more. Its story is told to you in full color for your podcasting ears. It's the story of how Jamaica conquered the world.
Search for it on iTunes, How Jamaica Conquered the World. It's probably the best least-known podcast in podcastdom. Search for it today.
Hey guys, my name is Zach Twomley, and I run the podcast When Diplomacy Fails. When Diplomacy Fails is a history podcast that looks at the build-up to, breakout of, and consequences of various wars in history. Now you might be thinking, a lot of podcasts cover a lot of wars in history, what makes When Diplomacy Fails so different? Well, that's a good question. From the very beginning, I wanted to have a different take based on my own interests. I didn't want to cover why Army A moved to B, or why this battle took place in this place, or why this technology was so important. I preferred to look at the whole human agency aspect of it, the diplomatic part of it, the reasons why war was necessary and peace simply could not be preserved. If you find yourself interested in such issues and you want to know why wars really happened, you should check out When Diplomacy Fails.
I would like to claim some deep, intelligent reason why you should listen to the history of England, and indeed, to the history of Anglo-Saxon England, to show you that my podcast will give you that flash of insight that makes you a better person, stronger, kinder, more insightful, and indeed, an endlessly attractive turn-on to everyone you meet. Sadly, you can't do that, because it'd be a whopper, but the history of England is a fantastically fun story with all the colours of life. The creation of a nation, the lives of ordinary folk across the ages, how Aristotle's view affected the lives of medieval women, why people have ginger hair, endlessly nasty and gory deaths, of course, intrigue, politics and sex. It's a cornucopia, a rainbow of love and laughter. I love it to bits, and my mum does too, so I strongly advise you, in a deeply objective way, to give it a whirl.
10 American Presidents is a podcast focused on delving deeper into the lives of some of the presidents who became the most influential in United States history, for better or for worse. Each episode provides a rich background of the man and America at the time, and how the mixture of both affected each president's decisions and legacy.
I'm Pete Coleman.
And I'm Travis Dow.
Together we host the Bohemian Podcast, a look at the tiny country of the Czech Republic that has played a big role in history. We talk about what it's like living in this historic capital of Bohemia, Prague, and take you through its incredibly fascinating history and how a tiny Slavic country managed to stay intact for a millennia while being surrounded by far larger neighbors. We also host the History of Alchemy podcast, a podcast about where the history of science meets the history of the occult and gets all wobbly. We cover all sorts of ideas around alchemy that have influenced alchemy in its 1400-year history and how it changed and evolved over time until we finally get to the modern science that we know and love. We take an in-depth look at specific alchemists, what they did. Join us for the history of magic, divination, esotericism, but also the sciences of astronomy, mathematics, optics, and chemistry.
I also translate The Secret Cabinet from German. It's done by a historian who goes by the Budla and who has a bit of a sick sense of humor. We talk about all those fascinating stories and artifacts of history that were hidden from the more sensitive folks in the past. And finally, I also host the History of Germany podcast. Like The Secret Cabinet, it's both in English and German. And having lived in Germany for 10 years, I hope to provide a bit of a local insight into Germany's history, starting from the very beginning.
And remember not to miss out on our videos.
Hi there. My name's Tom Daly, and I'd like to tell you about my podcast, American Biography. American Biography isn't just a chronological retelling of the history of the United States, but rather, it's an exploration of the human side of American history. I'm not interested in retreading the lives of the same old big names in the American pantheon, but instead, I want to look at judges, congressmen, cabinet members, civic leaders, or diplomats who, though less well-known, nonetheless significantly impacted the nation's evolutionary trajectory. In American biography, I want to underscore the private lives of these public people, to study their hopes and fears, their flaws and foibles, their brilliance and their boneheadedness, in order to achieve a more complete and relatable picture of the United States development. On American biography, I want to tell the American story through Americans' stories. So please join me, and together we'll learn more about the important people we don't know enough about.
Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm host and producer of A to Z History Presents The History of the Papacy. This is a podcast about the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. The History of the Papacy podcast is an interactive show where you will be joining our tour group that will visit all the usual interesting points in papal and Christian history. We will also step over the ropes and look at events and occurrences that don't normally come up in the official tour. From the early first century onward, the history of the popes of Rome and the Christian Church has made up a huge part of the history of the Western world. We will discover many interesting facts about the history of the popes of Rome, the Christian Church, and how this all fits into the larger narrative of world history. This podcast will be more than just a recounting of facts and biographies. We will lay out the narrative in the main episodes of the podcast, but we will also have sidetrack episodes. This is where we will lift the curtain and go in depth about tons of interesting facts and stories of church history. You will also hear expert interviews and guest hosts who will bring in other perspectives on the issues we discuss. If you want to learn more how Christianity was formed and transformed throughout the ages, I encourage you to give the show a try. Thank you, and I look forward to talking with you soon.
My name is Kate.
My name's Joe.
My name's Nicola.
My name is Suzanne Hakimi.
My name is Mary Parkinson.
I'm in Hope House as a client. I have had addiction issues throughout
Hope
my
House,
life, including an eating disorder,
heroin, crack,
addiction
drink,
to drugs,
methadone,
and to alcohol.
I'm here because it got really bad.
At long last, 1001 Conversations is available to download from iTunes and all good podcatchers.
This was a place where women worked to help other women.
Listen to Agora today.
Mr. Pop.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
67 years ago,
when in the course of human events,
and so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
There is not a black America and a white America.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Asian America, there's the United States.